you, Arnie.
Is everybody familiar with the Institute of Medicine? A little bit?
Okay, so I don't have to go into the history of it? Wonderful.
All right. So the Institute of Medicine is part of the National Academy of Sciences, and between the Institute of Medicine and the National Academy of Sciences, there's been a long history of conducting studies looking at the impacts of herbicide spraying in Vietnam. And so these are just examples of two of the projects that are ongoing that the Institute of Medicine is in the middle of. First of all, I have no relationships to disclose. So the first project I'm going to talk about is the Air Force Health Study, otherwise known as the Ranch Hand Study, Operation Ranch Hand. And these are the Air Force personnel who participated in herbicide spraying missions. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the types of data and biospecimens that were collected over a 20-year study of them, and then talk a little bit about what happened after that study's conclusion and what's being done with those data and biospecimens now, and then finish up with a recent report that just came out from the Institute of Medicine, the ninth biennial update of veterans and Agent Orange. Sure, can you hear me now? All right. Starting with the Air Force Health Study. The Air Force instigated an epidemiologic study back in 1979 due to concerns of long-term effects of exposure to herbicides. And that later morphed more into dioxin and Agent Orange specifically, but it started out as long-term exposure to herbicides in general. There were several revisions of the protocol before the 11th and final version was approved, and that began the study in 1982. The final protocol called for six examination cycles, and those were to be conducted at baseline, as you can see there in 1982, and then in years 3, 5, 10, 15, and 20. Who are these participants is probably what you want to know also. The first group were those Air Force personnel in terms of pilots, crews, and ground crews that actually participated in the herbicide spraying missions. And then there was a matched cohort to them. And these are Air Force personnel that were deployed to Southeast Asia, but had nothing to do with the spraying missions. And so both groups are matched on health status in general, so very broadly a kind of poor, fair, good, and as well as age, race, and their military occupation. So pilots were matched with pilots, ground crew with ground crew. Okay. So just as a general overview of the materials, the Institute of Medicine now holds detailed physical, mental, laboratory, and demographic data from 2,210 subjects who gave consent to have their materials used in future research and who participated in at least one exam. This is 80% of the original cohort that started in roughly 1982. In addition to the data collected, there are approximately 86,000 biospecimens contained in the repository. And these are serum samples, adipose tissue, semen, urine, and whole blood samples. Looking at the types of clinical examination data collected, we had everything from the blood draws, electrocardiograms, chest x-rays, psychological testing, dermatology exams, peripheral vascular exams, just about everything that they could think of at the time. And with each examination cycle, more was added, and then followed longitudinally, too, to see if there was any trends or what could be gleaned from that. So with this data, they were looking at health endpoints generally by organ system and general health overall. And so any of the reports that were released, you can see each chapter was dedicated to an organ system and what possible effects or differences you could see in the cohort. Now, in addition to the clinical exam,
There was questionnaire information. And so this was both demographic information and then more so of health habits, toxic substances exposure, their military experience, their wartime herbicide exposure, physical recreation and leisure activities. My colleague likes to say that you could actually examine trends in bullying with this cohort, and you could, because that's how detailed the information was that was collected. So at the end of the Air Force Health Study in 2002, again, the 20 years was up, and what's going to happen with this? They published their last report, their findings of pharmacokinetics of TCDD and health effects, increased levels of diabetes and spina bifida and in the children of the exposed members. So there has been a lot of scientific literature that has come out of the Air Force Health Study. But the question was there more that could be done with it? Is there more research, or is there different types of research that all of this, all of these materials could be used for? And so Congress asked the Institute of Medicine to take a look at that question and evaluate the scientific merit of maintaining these specimens and also using them for new research. That report came out in 2006, and there were quite a few conclusions and recommendations, but here were some of the best right now. Is the Air Force Health Study assets are unique. No other epidemiologic data set on Vietnam veterans contains as detailed information collected over as long a period of time. The data collected by the Air Force Health Study appears to be of high quality, and the specimens appear well preserved. Analysis of the Air Force Health Study has contributed to the literature addressing the health of Vietnam veterans, and therefore there is scientific merit in retaining and maintaining those resources after the study's conclusion. And further study or research on these materials is advisable. So based on those recommendations, Congress passed two more laws that were associated with the Air Force Health Study. The first said at the study's conclusion that the data and biospecimens should be transferred to the Institute of Medicine's custody. And the second law, which was part of the Veterans Benefit Improvement Act, specified that the Institute of Medicine is supposed to maintain and manage all of the assets. It allowed for additional research on the assets as the Institute of Medicine considered appropriate. And finally, it directed the Department of Veterans Affairs to provide funding to support the maintenance of, management of, and research on the assets. So that's the research program and how it got started. The actual research program itself is kind of two-faceted. The first is the infrastructure and management side, and that consisted of maintaining the data and biospecimens and making them usable for investigators. And then the second part is the actual research program itself. When the Institute of Medicine took custodianship of these materials, the data came in 125,000 disconnected text files that all had to be read in, interpreted, collated, cleaned, before they were even usable. And they all actually still haven't been read in. This program began in 2011, and we're about half through reading in those files. The most important files, of course, of each of the exam cycles and a lot of the health endpoints, that has all been read in, but some of the other information, such as x-rays and electrocardiograms, those are still in a flat file format. Okay. The Institute of Medicine also had to put in protocols and processes to both manage the biospecimens and then make them available for researchers. So in terms of processes to aliquot and ship them. And what's actually very important to note is that the Institute of Medicine does not have in-house capability to maintain the biospecimens. We are in a large office building in the middle of Washington, D.C. So to get around that, we contracted with the Air Force Research Laboratory of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and they hold the specimens for us. Okay. Now let's talk about the research side of the program. And this consists of soliciting proposals from researchers, reviewing and evaluating those proposals for scientific merit and making sure they pass IRB review, working collaboratively with successful applicants, disseminating available support money, which we had for 2 years of the research study, and then also promoting publication of these new research results. So the first part of this, of soliciting proposals, the Institute of Medicine has an advisory committee for this purpose, and the advisory committee made a request for proposals, which was then posted in May 2012, and the RFP is announced annually, or re-announced annually, I should say. Proposals are open to academic, government, and private sector researchers, as well as international applicants, and we actually have successful researchers in each of these categories. So, interested researchers must first submit a letter of intent. And the whole reason for this is to make sure that the data are available that a researcher is interested in, and also to make sure that the research question is hypothesis-driven and not just data mining or, you know, give us all the data and we'll come up with some research results. That's not the point of this program. Once letters of intent are accepted, investigators are invited to submit a full proposal. And these are then accepted on a rolling submission basis. There's no deadlines, and this gives investigators, or the committee feels this gives investigators more time to really design a good study and not, you know, rush just to get it into a deadline. Successful proposal applicants are then notified within about 4 weeks between submission and decision. Proposals are subjected to a rigorous scientific and IRB review. The advisory committee consists of 9 members and a chair, and the evaluations are based on the NIH study section process. All approved proposals are subject to 2 IRBs. The first one is the researcher's home institution, and the second one is through the National Academy of Sciences IRB. Once all the IRB approvals have been had, we collaborate with these investigators. And that's most of my job, is to make sure that the investigators are getting what they need. And so that's in terms of pilot funding, if they were awarded some, working with the data team to make a data set that's specific to the approved work and the scope of the approved work, working with the Air Force Research Laboratory to get the biospecimens that are needed. And investigators then are required to update the committee annually on the progress of their research. And then when they are finished, the hope is that they are publishing their results or at least applying for grants using results from the Air Force Health Study. And we request a copy of each of those. So what I think is the most exciting part of this is the research opportunities. And the Air Force Health Study, of course, has long been used for studying long-term health effects of dioxin and other herbicide exposure. And that can still be done using new analyses, methods, and models of herbicide and dioxin exposure on health effects, looking at other environmental, behavioral, and occupational exposures, reanalyzing some of the health outcomes that were examined during the original 20-year study, and now using different assumptions and approaches, expanding the period of analysis through follow-up using publicly available information such as the National Death Index if you wanted to do a follow-up of the mortality study, and additional follow-up of health, medical, and morbidity outcomes. And this is something that the committee made sure was in the consent to the study cohort, that they could be, if they wish to be recontacted, so that additional data could be collected on them if such a proposal was approved. And 90% of those who consented to have their data used in new research consented to be recontacted. So although the research using herbicide exposure and dioxin is well and good, but here's some examples of actually approved study proposals. And those include using different methods to estimate dioxin exposure more accurately, and using this then to reanalyze some of the health outcomes. We have an investigator examining specific chemical components in the herbicides and their association with Parkinson's disease and other conditions of motor function. And those two studies use data only, but half of the approved studies use both the data and the biospecimens. And so these bottom two use the biospecimens as well. So one of them was looking at testing serum samples in cycles 1, 3, and 5 to investigate whether dioxin is a risk factor for or influences the progression of MGUS, which is a disorder of immune cells, or malignant immune cells, I should say. And a second study was looking at the matched serum and adipose tissue materials to determine if there was an effect of dioxin on preclinical markers of amyloidosis. So the serum was samples were used to look for these biomarkers, and the presence of that was verified using adipose tissue samples. Those were still based on the dioxin and herbicide exposure, but there's really more to that and more than that that can be done with this cohort. And so some of the research opportunities that are available include long-term health outcomes and changes in biomarkers, DNA methylation, or other measures, new assays and technologies that permit biomarker, genotype, or other analyses that were not possible during the original Air Force Health Study, using biospecimens for early detection, identification of therapeutic targets, or disease response markers. We have a couple approved proposals that are looking specifically in that category. Investigators in related but often overlooked disciplines such as aging and geriatric health, environmental, behavioral, and occupational exposures on health outcomes, and additional follow-up, as I said, of health, medical, or mortality outcomes in AFHS participants is also a possibility. Talking about related disciplines, if anybody is interested in looking at research on aging, this is an NIH opportunity, which looks at the analyzing existing data sets and stored biospecimens, which the AFHS is pretty perfect for. So if anybody's looking for money and interested, please see that one. Okay. So what's next with this program? The Institute of Medicine is overseen by an advisory committee, as I mentioned, and they are responsible for the administrative oversight, reviewing the proposals, and making sure the management is up to best practices. However, the National Academy of Sciences does not allow advisory committees to make recommendations, and so at the end of this program, Congress asked the Institute of Medicine to make a final report on, based on the experience so far, is it advisable and feasible to maintain these research assets for future research? So based on that, the Institute of Medicine had to appoint a consensus committee to look at that question. And so that report is actually, will be released in March. So before I go on to the second project that Institute of Medicine is involved with, does anybody have any questions? Please.
When they reopen the study, do they also go back to the control group?
Yes. Sorry if I didn't specify that enough. That's what I meant by the entire cohort, is both the ranch hands and their matched controls. So data is available for 2,210 of these subjects. I would tell them that I think there's a lot of opportunities, and some of it was looking specifically at the biospecimens using new technologies, assays that haven't been done before. But really it's not a data mining is what I would tell grad students, is that they should come with a specific question, but chances are that question could be looked at with this, just with the amount of data collected on this cohort over the 20 years. And so then you could also, if you chose, do a follow-up study. I have one approved investigator with the Department of Veterans Affairs right now that has linked the administrative medical data on a sub-cohort, a subpopulation of this, and followed up for the next 10 years. So the study and the data collection was over in 2002, but he has records on a subset of this through 2012. So there's information there, and there is the opportunity to actually go back to those cohort members who consented to be recontacted, you know, if you made up a specific questionnaire, per se, and to ask them to complete that you could use. That's a good question, and I don't think I'm the best person to ask, because the committee has ultimate say. So my advice would be submit a letter of intent and let the committee review it. In general, like I said, it's not a data mining expedition, but if there are general broad classes that you're interested in or categories, you know, if you're looking at cardiovascular health in general, you know, you don't have to say ischemic heart disease.
And you said two things which caught my attention. You said when we had money, when IOM had money. Are you still short of money to fund future research projects?
So the Institute of Medicine, if there's pilot funding available or if there is to help. And the answer to that question is there was in the last 2 years, but there is not pilot funding available this year for researchers. So researchers, that would be another limit, is you have to come with your own funds. But the data is free. The biospecimens are on a cost recovery basis, which I think is about $12 a sample, and it doesn't matter what type of sample. So in the scheme of things, relatively cheap.
And one other question. Mm-hmm. You mentioned blood and adipose tissue, fat tissue, being studied for some immune function. I wasn't quite sure I understood what point.
Amyloid light chain amyloidosis was a study on that used both the serum samples and adipose tissue samples.
Why both?
So the investigator was looking at the at biomarkers or potential biomarkers in the serum and then using the adipose tissue to verify the diagnosis. So that's another example. Looking at long-term health outcomes in terms of their serum collected at all six cycles. So you can see over a 20-year period how a biomarker changes maybe. And we have a couple of studies looking at that too. We've had 75 inquiries, had about 30 letters of interest or intent submitted. And right now we're following 12 approved studies. So more of a kind of a pilot research program. We're not NIH, but it would be nice to be that one day. So, all right. Shall I continue? All right. So the second project at Institute of Medicine.
Is it possible to get the information about the proposals?
Do you want the? Are you asking for abstracts on them? I'll have to look into that, but that will be released as part of the final report in March. Yes. The proposal process and the specific RFP is listed on the website, which I was going to put up at the end of this. So the second project that Institute of Medicine is involved in, or currently involved in with Agent Orange, is our Veterans and Agent Orange Biennial Updates. And so this is, we just released the 9th of those reports. And this is a 20-year endeavor that is congressionally mandated. And it's a report series that releases biennial updates of the, that review the literature collected since the previous update comes out and draws conclusions on the overall evidence concerning associations between health outcomes and exposure to herbicides, specifically Agent Orange. So in the 9th update, the Institute of Medicine put together a committee to determine with respect to possible health effects from exposure to herbicides used during the military operations in Vietnam, three things. Whether a statistical association of disease with herbicide exposure exists, taking into account the strength of the scientific evidence and the appropriateness of the statistical and epidemiologic methods used to detect the association, it's a mouthful, the increased risk of diseases in question among those exposed to herbicides during Vietnam service, and finally, whether there exists a plausible biologic mechanism or other evidence of a causal relationship between herbicide exposure and the diseases in question. So here's for the chemicals of interest. We have Agent Orange and its components, cacodylic acid, and pichlorum. So with each of these committees, the approach is generally a literature review. And these literature reviews include all relevant primary peer-reviewed literature on the chemicals of interest that were published since the last update. So in this case, from 2010 to 2012. They also look at epidemiologic studies of human populations, including those on Vietnam veterans, occupational exposures, and environmental exposures. Toxicologic investigations, particularly as they support the understanding of mechanisms of action and biologic plausibility. And so this committee screened almost 7,000 abstracts and reviewed over 700 peer-reviewed journal articles, including 60 of these from epidemiologic studies, new epidemiologic studies. So some of these major studies reviewed, including the included the Cardia study, which looked for analyses of association of dioxin-like compounds in diabetes in young adults. We had the PIVUS study, again looking at dioxin-like compounds and cardiovascular disease, but in the elderly, as well as some other related outcomes. We had the Seveso cohort, the IARC subcohort studies, looking at cancer incidence, asthma, and immune function, and finally looking at NHANES data. And again, dioxin-like compounds and the metabolic and pubertal effects in mother-son pairs, obesity, and hypertension. Now, the committee puts each of the diseases into four outcomes of association. We have sufficient evidence of an association, limited or suggestive evidence of an association, inadequate or insufficient evidence to determine whether such an association exists, And finally, limited or suggestive evidence of no association. So based on those categories, the committee found the following. There's sufficient evidence of association for chloracne and for four cancers, including Hodgkin lymphoma, non-Hodgkin lymphoma, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and soft cell sarcoma. Soft tissue sarcoma, sorry. Limited or suggestive evidence of an association exists for the following outcomes. And the only update from the previous biennial report was that stroke was now added to this list. So again, we have some cancers, spina bifida in the offspring of exposed individuals, Parkinson's disease, hypertension, AL amyloidosis. For limited or suggestive evidence of no association, there was only one outcome, and that's spontaneous abortions following paternal exposure to TCDD. Now, for inadequate or insufficient evidence to determine association, the rest of the diseases looked at fall into this category. And it's just because there's not enough high-quality data to really make an association or a determination, I should say, of association. And so also health outcomes for which there are no data will by default fall into this category as well. So that's the rest of the cancers that were examined. These are all cancers on this first page, including esophagus, stomach, breast, pancreas, melanoma. If anybody's looking for a particular type of cancer there. And this also includes a whole bunch of other outcomes, including non-malignant myeloid disease, which was a newly looked at outcome for this, for the ninth biennial update. But also includes things, conditions in offspring of exposed individuals, neurobehavioral disorders, hearing loss, eye problems, bone conditions, a whole slew of other things. There's just not the data there. So in conclusion, the data accrued over the last 2 years support the conclusions of association drawn by previous Veterans and Agent Orange committees, with one exception, and that is stroke, which was moved to the limited and suggestive category of association. And the possibility of adverse health effects in offspring of Vietnam veterans remains a high priority with the veterans, but there's no data there to establish or refute. So that committee came out with five recommendations. The first was that the Department of Veterans Affairs should evaluate possibilities for studying health outcomes in Vietnam-era veterans by using existing administrative and health services database. And they also proposed to link these records to DOD service records to see if there was the possibility of making an epidemiologic study out of that. Available information should be gleaned from existing cohort studies, such as the Air Force Health Study, and they particularly recommended a longitudinal follow-up of the study, looking, I believe, at melanoma outcomes. Possible health effects in offspring of exposed men merit further investigation. There's a need for epidemiologic studies of incidence of COPD. And finally, there's a need for new animal models to elucidate mechanisms of disease and disease progression, specifically for cardiovascular outcomes, and I believe B-cell cancers as well. So. I'd like to thank the Institute of Medicine program staff of both of these projects, and also the Institute of Medicine committees that make this work possible, as well as the veterans who continue to allow their materials to be used in new research. And for additional information, please see our website or send me an email, and I'd be happy to help. Yes? Yes, the The Veterans and Agent Orange Committee suggested that there should be additional epidemiologic studies looking at melanoma. And that specifically, they said that such a study should be done using the Air Force Health Study. Acne and four cancers. That there's no evidence of an association. That was this one.
But there were very few women in the study. So it has to have been journal exposure.
There are actually no women in the Air Force Health Study, by the way.
Yeah, the new health study, the Air Force Health Study, has been studied, or is it being studied, the epigenetic effects? Are there any proposals that we're looking at that particular?
Yes. There's one approved study that's looking at that. And that study is using whole blood, semen and adipose tissue to look at intra and inter differences, so between tissues and also between exposed people.
In the previous studies, was there any association, just an epidemiological association between effects on cohorts,
so there was a companion reproductive study along with the longitudinal morbidity study. And I know that they found some associations, but I don't have that. And I can't remember it right now, but I know we do have one at least approved proposal, and he's looking at those outcomes again or reanalyzing them to see if there's still an association. That's a good question. I can ask the study director. I was not on that study.
And do you recall why melanoma?
Again, I was asked to summarize that study, but I was not a member of the committee or the project staff.
Yeah, on the reproductive and the abortions, you have the problem that not every offspring from a male who served in Vietnam in a military capacity is known. You don't only have your children with your wife. So that's one problem that comes up. And then the abortion, the spontaneous abortions, is fairly strong evidence in the animal literature. If a female is dosed with DCD of spontaneous abortion, well, of spontaneous abortion. Cardiovascular findings, I think, came as a surprise to many of us. Increased heart attack mortality. That was a surprise to me. A relatively recent finding. But of course, the Congress is then faced with the situation that there's only so much money to go around, and for common events, you want to increase money spent.
So this last evidence update, that's it.
There's one more in progress, and this will be the last one. 2016 is when it will come out, and that should be the last of these updates until Congress passes another law for another 20 years. Generally, because the sponsor is either the Department of Veterans Affairs, Department of Defense, or Congress itself. That is who we direct our reports to.
How much money is spent by ILM each year on this work that you described?
Well, the Department of Veterans Affairs decided that we would get $600,000 to perform this work.
For both tasks?
No. Oh, no, Veterans and Agent Orange is a different study. I don't know that. I'm not the study director.
So it's not a lot of money.
It's not. So all committee members serve pro bono. All right. Well.
Any